Sometimes you choose courage, and at other times it's forced upon you. Courage Unraveled is a podcast series where you get to listen to insights, discussions, conversations, and stories from people from all walks of life. You'll be served with dollops of courage, resilience, and strength here. So come along and be educated and inspired. You just may find new ways to flex your own courage muscle. My name is Sana Turnock, and I'm your host. Maury Morgan is a man of ideas. So many, in fact, that he keeps on creating new businesses. His latest venture is co-founder of the School of Hard Knock Knocks in Melbourne, Australia. What is it? It's a comedy school, essentially, set up prior to COVID-19 that isn't just good for comedian wannabes, but also for bucket list tickers and people with mental health challenges. We talk comedy in this interview and have a laugh along the way, but there is so much that we talk about. Learn about how GFC almost decimated his then business and how he came through. Understand the driving force behind Maury being a serial entrepreneur and how this event has influenced how he also lives his life. We cover COVID-19 and living in Beijing, the thought of going back to Melbourne and straight into lockdown, and Britney Spears breaking through mental glass ceilings gets a mention. And wait, there's more. This is a rich interview. Get settled and join me as I speak with Maury Morgan. It's a real privilege to be able to share these inspiring podcasts of courage with you. The work undertaken takes many hours to put together and is self-funded. Become a Courage Unraveled patron on Patreon, and not only will you be supporting the podcast, you will also be helping yourself by investing in your own courage. Get access to pre-release episodes and patron-only specials. It's easy being a patron, and the first tiers are less than 2 coffees per month. Cultivate and flex your courage muscle by signing up for a one-to-one Grow Into My Courage program and grab your very own journal. You grow your courage muscle by activating it. Listen to the podcasts, grab yourself the courage journal, sign up to the Grow Into My Courage program and become a patron. After this episode, head over to courageunraveled.com. It's all happening there. Grow into your courage today. Hello, Maury, and welcome to Courage Unraveled.
Thank you very much, Sana. Very good to be here.
I'm glad you've made it. I just want to ask you this question before we actually start formally, and that is, would you call yourself a serial entrepreneur?
Yes, I would, because I have come to the realization that when a business either fails or succeeds, I don't get too excited because I know that there's another business idea not far away. Yeah, so that means I know I'm a serial entrepreneur. I used to be married to the idea, and it would kill me when I sold it or it failed, but now I don't. Now I don't get emotional.
How about that? Yeah, that takes skill, I think.
Or a lot of practice of failing or succeeding to get over it.
Lessons learnt along the way.
Yes, definitely.
I want to jump into 2009 because you've mentioned that was a challenging time for you professionally and personally. And it was during the time of the GFC, the global financial crisis. Yep. You had to reduce your company's staff from 84 to 24.
Yes.
And you also had a good friend die at the age of 34. So some very big things going on there. What was the internal dialogue for you at the time?
The global financial crisis hit just after I had proposed to my now wife. We were also pregnant at that time, so I knew that my son was going to be born into a new period of time. I didn't know if the GFC was going to be short-lived or long-lived. What was going through my mind at the time was one step at a time. There was a lot of stress because my wife was pregnant and I had to fill the space left by, as you mentioned, 40-odd staff had left. So obviously people were taking it in the slack. And I recall vividly that there was a lot of arguments between my wife and I, who I was just trying to keep the company alive. She was under stress, you know, obviously hormones racing through her body. But we managed. That was probably the most stressful time in our relationship, but we managed to get through it. It was like, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. One bite at a time. That's it. That's all it takes.
Wow. That is pretty full on. I'm a business advisor in my day job, so I understand, yes, especially now with COVID, you know, and what COVID has done to some of the businesses that I'm assisting, what that's doing to them. So I think there's a similarity there. but you also had your friend pass. I mean, was that months apart or was it like weeks apart?
Oh, it was a little bit later. He died about a year later or more. So, but he was a, you know, a young guy. Well, sorry. Well, this is how somber this conversation is going to be. I had two friends pass. So at this moment, my mind is actually thinking of the second one. But yes, Dylan died. Dylan was a Kiwi friend of mine who I worked with in Melbourne, and he died at the age of 34. My son was born when I was 34. Dylan was about a year older than I was. And so when he died, I was 33. And when my son was born, I was 34. Then 2 years later, an American friend of mine who I knew from Beijing, he died. My son was named Dylan. Dylan had died at the age of 34. And okay. I was 34 when Dylan was born. So it was a reminder that every day, give your best, give your most. The one thing I fear is regret. I fear that I will not do something. So I do it. And that has driven me in business since my son was born.
Okay. And I want to talk about that a little bit later. In terms of GFC, your business, having to tell 50, 60 of your staff that you have to let them go, that's no mean feat. How did that impact you in moving forward?
The good thing, it's an ironic word, the good thing about the global financial crisis was it wasn't my fault. It was the fault of the world, right? It was a universal negativity that everyone, like COVID-19, has had. So I wasn't to blame, which I think was the saving grace in that circumstance. If it had been my incompetence as a leader that had caused the business to fail, then absolutely, it would have been a lot more pressure. But the staff were super in that they didn't take it personally. No one got angry at me. Everyone gave me a hug. We had very little cash to be able to pay out. I mean, we gave everyone these brand new computers that we'd bought, laptops that we'd bought 6 months before, and they were happy with that as a payout. And those were some substantial laptops. And a few of the foreign staff took it on their own to quit rather than to be fired, because they understood that if they were to be fired, there would be a payout required, and they just didn't want to do that. I think ultimately we had just such a strong family or a community feel within the company, and so there was no vengeful behavior by anyone, thank God, because when you have 65 people and if you've been a prick of a boss, the whole thing can come crashing down. And ultimately we were able to pivot so that we actually put on a huge talk, like a TED talk actually, in the tallest, at the time, the tallest building in China, the Shanghai World Financial Center. So in November, I was firing people. By March, I was putting on this huge conference as a way of maintaining marketing and rebounding from this negativity.
You were so fortunate that your staff did what they did and responded in the way that they responded. That's amazing. So the loss of your friend, the almost total collapse of the business made you realise that life is short, that our own self-beliefs are stopping us from achieving what we want, as well as the fear of what others will say. That's something that you've brought up. So were these light bulb moments or something that you came to realise over time?
Totally serendipitous, but I'm a big believer in planned serendipity, which happened to, by the way, the slogan of that conference that I ran in 2009. It was called Spark 09. And the whole idea was I had got through, you know, pivoting my business, letting go of 40 staff and redesigning what we were going to offer the market. And I wanted to share this with everyone else. And take a step back, a year earlier, I brought over an Australian from Melbourne, a fellow called Dr. Michael Hewitt Gleeson. Dr. Michael Hewitt Gleeson is one of the co-founders of the Six Thinking Hats, and Edward de Bono coined it. It was called the Six Thinking Caps, which of course makes complete sense because we, within our English linguistic system, we understand that it's put your thinking cap on. I had a bit of a falling out. One thing being the other, the Six Thinking Hats became a world's bestseller under the name of Edward de Bono. But the original idea was caps, and that's been documented by the Reader's Digest, so it is in print. Anyway, Michael Hewitt Gleeson and I befriended one another about a year earlier in Melbourne, and I flew him over to Shanghai, and then we did a tour of Beijing as well in order to for him to share his innovative thinking techniques. Basically, he's a, I guess what you call a lateral thinker. He teaches people how to think.
Is he the father that's coined the power of 10 thinking?
Yes, X10. So yeah, X10's one of the... Yeah, so he's got all these memes. He's a big believer in memes. Anything that can be converted into an acronym or something that's easily memorable. So X10, CVS to BVS. CVS to BVS is current view of the situation versus the better view of the situation. And the whole idea in that is right now, if your podcast listeners are listening, right now you know that you've had problems that you've solved. Like 5 years ago, even last week, there was a problem that you didn't know how to solve. But right now, in this moment in time, you know you solved it. It's fixed. So where did that idea come from? Well, it probably came from an outside source, a friend. You read something, you heard something, and boom, in your head, there was the solution and you solved that problem. So it happens all the time. Now put us in the problem. The current view of the situation is that period of time when we are currently with limited resources, with limited thinking, but we should remember and we should always remind ourselves that it is never better than the better view of the situation, and that there is always a better view of the situation once we get more information, whether that's through a podcast like this one, Sana, mm-hmm. or
Yay.
through having a conversation, reading a book, walking down the street and seeing something that just pricks our imagination and creates an idea. And that's what Michael did for me. He saved my company through thinking.
Wow. So it's not about reframing. It's something different.
Reframing is to say, look, you know, I lost my wallet and it doesn't matter because I really hated my driver's license photo and now I get a chance to get a new driver's license photo, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's looking at a bad thing and saying, well, it's not that bad. CVS to BVS says, I'm in a bit of a pickle right now, whether it's I don't have anywhere to stay or I've lost my job or I don't know how to get more customers. And it's understanding that the solution is a step away. Now, you don't know which direction that step is and you don't know when that step's going to come, but it is a step away. And just knowing that there is a better view of the situation, it removes that word hopelessness. Mm. Hopelessness creates anxiety. And when I learned that, I've always been relatively optimistic, but even just today, on a chat with a friend, he said, Maurie, you are so optimistic. And I honestly am, because I know that even when there's bad times, like COVID-19, there's an opportunity. There's a better view of the situation.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for clarifying that for me and also for the listeners. That's fantastic. How did you meet Michael Gleeson?
Michael's part of the Speakers Bureau. So he was one of the, I think he was ICMI. There's also Saxton's in Australia. And I got introduced through a fellow called Chris Moody, who I became very good friends with as well. And to this day, Chris and I are good friends as well. And he came over to China to try and pitch a whole bunch of speakers. And Dr. Michael Hewitt Gleeson was one of them. And I felt that he had the best to offer at the time in 2000. And I think it was 2007. I think when Michael Hewitt Gleeson came over, I thought that Shanghai in particular could use a little bit of his creative thinking. So again, all serendipitous.
Planned serendipity.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. How did it actually change you? You know, through what you learned from Dr. Michael Hewitt Gleeson, how did it actually change your thinking, change the way you dealt with business and also just challenges in your life?
When I met Michael, who must be 70 years of age now. When I met him, he was in his early 60s. When I met him, I read a book first. His book is called Wombat Sales, and Wombat stands for Word of Mouth, Buy and Tell, which this was 2007, the equivalent of influencer marketing that we know today. So he was certainly ahead of his time, just with a different acronym. I was using the language of KOL, Key Opinion Leader, at the time, which I hadn't coined, which was from my pharmaceutical days. And there was another thing that he was big on in his book, Wombat Sales, and that was the concept of check. And the idea of checking is that the customers only think about you when you remind them that you exist. And that's why, for example, McDonald's has a McDonald's symbol 5 kilometres before the McDonald's, you know, restaurant on the highway.
Yes.
Because it creates that check mode. Now, you can create a check in many ways. This podcast right now has just given you a check for McDonald's, and there's a good chance that some people right now are actually thinking about eating McDonald's, but a minute ago they weren't. unfortunately. Sorry about that. I'm not a big fan of
Don't go promoting the golden arches. No, I
apologize. It's probably the best example, though, because they just get
Yes.
You know, they just bombard you, and they bombard you at the right time as well, you know, within Absolutely. Those hunger pangs. To answer your question, the first thing I realized was I wasn't the only one thinking about this. In fact, I built a CRM system that measured checks, whether it was a phone call or an email. I actually gave point systems. So an email was worth 1 point, whereas a phone call was worth 5 points and a face-to-face meeting was worth 15 points. And Michael Hewitt Gleason heard about this and he was like, well, this is what I write about in my book. So going back to your question, he and I just saw eye to eye immediately in terms of sales. So it confirmed my belief. And at that point in time, I was the only one, and I wrote a book on selling and I was teaching selling. I was the only one who was saying this. And I really didn't have any evidence from a third party. So that was nice. The second thing was he just opened my eyes up to new ways of thinking and how powerful the brain is just by creating a new version of the future.
I guess maybe creating new neural pathways.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I created an idea called idea, concept, idea. And I asked him about a month ago, did you give me this idea? And he said, no, I don't think so, but it's an awesome idea. Definitely. And it was a neural pathway transfer. So basically a way of taking two steps away from your initial idea, because as you're suggesting with that comment, nothing is unique because our neural Correct. Pathways are set. So how do we create truly innovative ideas? Well, we have to create a completely new road. We have to go bush bash. We have to get the machetes out and go through part of the brain that hasn't yet been tapped. So I've been a big believer in a concept called idea, concept, idea. Used it in my recent business. Yeah, so definitely neural pathway shifting.
Yep, very powerful stuff. Earlier you mentioned that you live by the mantra, go big or go home.
Yeah.
So along with what took place again in 2009, is this why you decided to start up the Comedy School of Hard Knock Knocks?
Well, it's pretty much why I do anything these days, actually, whether it's skydiving, not through choice, it was a birthday present, but I was like, well, okay. Go big or go home. And it was because I was in China in the early 2000s and the rules that China had, the literal laws, not just kind of the rule of thumb, were so vague and so opaque at the time. Things have changed since then. This, we're talking early 2000s, that what was considered illegal in a business sense, like you can't advertise this or you can't say that, was very unclear. And we were very cautionary at the beginning when we launched our business, our training business back in 2001 in Shanghai.
You're talking about the School of Hard Knock Knocks?
I'm sorry, I always go back to Clark Morgan. This is my first business at the age of 25. And it was coined because I took a gamble. I put an ad in the mainstream newspaper of Shanghai called the Shanghai Daily. And technically I was breaking the law with what we said were doing. And nothing happened. We got customers. We didn't get a knock on the door by the police. It was 2001, so I think I'm safe now. I don't think they can arrest me.
you can voice it.
yeah, that's right. So that's 2001. So going back to the School of Hard Knocks, which was founded in 2016, I just had this certain level of arrogance that you can just try anything. But more importantly, I wasn't afraid of anything. You know, I'd worked in China at that point, you know, 16 years. And I just wasn't scared about what people in the comedy business said about me at all. You know, people who'd been in the business for 5 or 6 years saying, oh, you can't do that, or you can't do that. I was like, who cares? I lived in China. I could have been arrested any day of the week for not carrying my passport.
So you became fearless, Murray. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, well, up until I had my child, and then my wife said, stop being fearless, Murray. Stop being responsible. Yeah.
Yeah, it's either crazy or courageous. Which one is it? Or irresponsible. That's another one. What drew you to actually invest and develop a comedy school?
Well, again, I think the theme of this and possibly the title of this will be serendipity, completely serendipity. So there I was as a China expert traveling around Asia, and I was in Thailand giving a presentation to a room of 70 people from a big Johnson & Johnson company, from people from all over, India, China, Singapore and Thailand. And I was there to give a keynote speech and the projector didn't work. I turned to the technician who worked for the Grand Hyatt in Bangkok. He waved at me in broken English and hand signals. He said, 5 minutes, 5 minutes. And so I said, yeah, sure, I can do an activity. You know, we've all got 5 minutes in us. And I did some kind of silly activity culturally between the different people that were there, different countries that were there. And after 5 minutes, I turned to him and I was like, I had a big thumbs up. And he looked at me in shock and said, no, five more minutes. And I had nothing. I was like, that's it. I've only got 5 minutes. I told my wife that story. We're on a Melbourne tram. I still remember we're going down Collins Street. And she turned to me on the tram and she said, Maury, why didn't you just do some stand-up comedy? Like as if everyone who goes to school in Australia learns stand-up comedy is like an elective or, you know, it's part of your VCE or something. I looked at her and went, what do you mean? And then where she typed it on a phone and she pulled up a website. And the website said that in 2 weeks' time, there was a stand-up comedy school in Melbourne and there was spaces available. And so I signed up and did the course. And having 16 years of training experience at a very high level in the corporate space, I did the course with two eyes open, one to learn comedy so that in a keynote speaking environment, I could add humor to any stressful situation. But the other eye was like, okay, this guy's running this course, but I would improve this, I would improve that, I would change this. And so I walked out of that with some terrible jokes, but a really good idea about how to change or create a business based on this. It's a very niche business. In Australia today, there's probably maybe three or four companies or individuals that do stand-up comedy as a business, not just sort of for fun. And I had met a stand-up comedian and I said to him, look, I think I could do this over Christmas. I can build the program. At that point in time, I'd had at one point 85 full-time staff and 7 offices around China. So I knew how to run a company. And we did. We opened our first course and we had 10 students and we charged very little. And it was very much an MVP, minimum viable product idea. And 2019, which has been the best year, 2020, as we all know, has been a crap of a year for everyone. But 2019 was awesome. We opened in Sydney, Adelaide, and we had courses in Melbourne, of course, all from that era, all from that horrible experience of 5 minutes.
Way back then. The seed was planted by your wife.
Yes, I'll thank her, and I'll also thank that technician for being very poor at fixing projectors. Because if he'd been super quick, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
It's so remarkable. Now that you're in China, what's your role with the comedy school now or at the moment?
I'm still the founder and I still do all the marketing and accounting. So no one gets paid without me moving money around, which is always important as a founder to control the money. I'm going back the 3rd of September. I will arrive, fingers crossed, in Melbourne Airport. Yes. Virus-free, I should add. I live in Beijing. It's one of the cleanest cities in terms of COVID-19 in the world.
Glad you said that. But you still have to go into lockdown though when you get back to Melbourne.
So I have to pay money to a hotel to sit there for 14 days with my family, even though I've had 2 tests already in China and I'm clean and there's no new cases in Beijing. To answer your question, for the last 18 months, I've been back and forth to Australia prior to COVID, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival last year and Adelaide Fringe last year as well. We have a whole team that runs the School of Hard Knock Knocks.
So you're still knee-deep in it, which sounds good, like very much hands-on. I've noticed that you've got people like Richard Stubbs, Dave O'Neill, Greg Fleet, Glenn Nichols. They're all well-known Australian comedians for those who are listening who don't know. How did you actually get access to these comedians to be part of the teaching program?
The easiest answer to that is you just ask, but you need to have rapport with them to begin with. And what we're doing right now, and this goes out to anyone who's listening to this, podcasts are the best way to break bread, metaphorically, with people you don't know. Because if you just send an email or a Facebook message to somebody and say, hey, I'd love for you to work with me, they don't know who you are. But when you go to them and say, I'm doing a podcast, it's on whatever theme your podcast's on, and preferably it should be related to your business. And my podcast is called The School of Hard Knock Knocks, which is the name of the school.
Yes.
So the very first person I got was Ben Horowitz, who's the co-founder, and I interviewed him. So we got number one, which appeals to one of my many mantras, and that is the second mouse gets the cheese, because the first mouse is killed, of course, by the mouse trap. So I created the first mouse, and that was Ben Horowitz. He's a comedian, and he's my co-founder. The second person I got, I think, was Tim Ferguson, who's Doug Anthony All-Stars fame. I think it might have been Brad Oakes, but anyway, some good names for the second and third, and then the fourth and the fifth, they just cut. It was so easy. I just sent an email, hey, Glenn, you know, to Glenn Nicholas, for example, hey, Glenn, I've interviewed Tim Ferguson, would love to interview you. This is what it sounds like, so you get an idea. And then Glenn says, yeah, absolutely. So Glenn's being interviewed by me. And then at the end, I might mention something like, hey, we do run these training courses in Melbourne. Would love to have you in. And we pay you, of course. That's also a benefit for him. Would you be interested in coming along? They can only say no. And in most cases, they say yes.
That's fantastic. It's so natural. And I've got to say, I've met some amazing people just doing this. My world's completely opened up and it is seriously wonderful. I absolutely love talking to the people that I've spoken to so far.
Yeah.
I had a bit of a read on your website just with people's testimonials regarding the School of Hard Knock Knocks. And a couple of them I would like to read out. One of them says, this course gave me the tools and the courage to perform stand-up comedy and for which I'm eternally grateful. And that was Lee Ton, Fringe Festival comedian. And then paraphrasing, this is Zoe Broughton, who is a lawyer. Just do this course. It's a thrilling, upskilling, fear-killing experience. I love that.
Yeah.
So there are some amazing skills that people can learn from undertaking the comedy course. And you mentioned it earlier, you know, you can really enhance your presentation skills and add humour to being on stage if you're presenting and without necessarily moving into a career in comedy. So looking at the modules, this course really is quite suitable for simply speaker development.
Yeah, absolutely. We probably, in any course, we get between 12 and 15 students. I'd say one third are comedian wannabes. They actually want to go out there and start a career. One third are bucket list tickers. You know, we get, and they can be all ends of the spectrum. They can be quite young bucket list tickers and they can be quite older. Yeah. And then we get someone like Zoe that you mentioned, who is a keynote speaker that adds that comedy angle, as I did. In fact, I came into this whole business from that camp. I wanted to add humor into my keynote speaking business, which is good for any business to have a segmented audience. If you're just pitching to one audience, it can be a bit dangerous if that audience is affected by one or two particular incidents like COVID or whatever.
If you can build the solid foundations first with each demographic, then when something like COVID hits, hopefully you don't lose everything. You speak about the bucket list. I like to call it a courage or a courageous life list because, you know, you want to do things, have the courage to stand up on stage and just let it all hang out. I was listening to Will Ferrell. He was on a podcast recently and he said his first comedy act was a bomb. He just said he failed dismally and he loved it. He said it was really good. It was a great learning for him. And he just said, well, I've hit rock bottom. I can only go higher, you know, than where he hit. So that was kind of cool. So there is a comedian side of you then. Would that be fair to say?
Look, I don't take things too seriously. Of all my high school friends, there's probably myself and one other guy who's an electrician to this day. And he and I have always been jokers. You're at a wedding, you're at something serious and you're punching each other in the ribs and making jokes, snide remarks, and then you remember that you're in your 40s, that kind of thing. You're like, I've just never taken things too seriously. That's why I'm not in banking or an accountant. So I think that there's certain personality traits that you do need to take things seriously. I think I would make a very bad neural surgeon.
Well, you might be laughing all the time, you know, as you're knee-deep in someone's kind of brain or their nervous system.
Yeah.
Cracking a gag.
Yeah, this man's not going to be able to taste cauliflower again. Watch this. Bing.
Yeah, oops, I got the wrong nerve there.
Yeah.
The School of Hard Knock Knocks is co-produced a comedy drama series called Is This Thing On? Alongside the company Mezzanine Films.
Yep.
It has 6 episodes. I've only been able to see 2 on YouTube. What did you learn from watching people transform themselves?
Because we'd seen so many people transform, I just had to get it on film. I think at that point we'd run 20 or 30 courses, and that's my co-founder Ben Horowitz and I. And without a doubt, every single course, whether it was Adelaide, Melbourne or Sydney, every single course, there was always a wacko, a weirdo, an oddie, a crazy, you know. And I mean that in a perfectly loving way. Often we'd hug them and actually say that you're the wacko of this course, and they'd be proud. We always knew from these experiences, you get the people who want to be on stage, they want to be the center of attention, that they're normally the oddballs. But then you also get people who open up through a very emotional, and whether they've had trauma in their life, schizophrenics, we've had PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, we've had bipolar, we've had people with chronic depression come through the course. And of course, that's not to be laughed at. They open up to us and they see the funny side. And it is such an emotional roller coaster, not only for them, but for everyone, including the trainers. And I'm an observer. I'm always there as a facilitator. What I do is make sure that the resident comedians are on time, that they follow the schedule accurately, and I turn the lights on and off. That's what I do. And then I walk around the groups and engage. I really, really love it. When I went to Stig Weems, who's the owner and director and producer of Mezzanine Films out of South Melbourne, in Melbourne, I said to him, look, we just have these emotional experiences every time we run the course, two or three times a month. I think this needs to be a show. And we brainstormed how it would be filmed because we didn't want to script it. We didn't want to tell people what to say. That would be fake. But at the same time, there was no guarantee that we would get that crazy energy, the trauma and the emotion. And thank God we did. And if you watch the show, even episodes 1 and 2, you'll see a guy get hypnotized, doesn't remember his name. You know, his name's Stephen and he forgets his name. We have two ladies, one's from Sydney, one's from Melbourne, but they both grew up in Frankston in Melbourne. And they have a bit of a verbal argument, quite a heated argument. You get a guy that broke up with his fiance a week before he signed up for the course. He has an emotional breakdown. And we had a guy called Grant who had open heart surgery a month earlier and almost died.
I remember Grant. Yes, I remember Grant. I saw his scar.
And the amazing thing, all these people are random. We didn't select them. They didn't go into a pool of 1,000 people like Australia's Got Talent. And we just went, all right, who's the weirdest ones we can bring in? This is Australia. If you complain about politics, well, have a watch of, is this thing on? Because these are the people that vote in Australia.
You talked about the mental health conditions that some of these people have. That is seriously courageous to basically do comedy, be a student of comedy, and then to allow themselves to be filmed and then to go on stage. They're opening themselves up. They're being really vulnerable.
And if you remember episode 2, they not only open themselves up, they take everything off as well. Mayumi the Betsu.
That was brilliant.
Is fantastic. She's a Japanese-born comedian. And she gets the 10 students, 50-50 women to men, and she gets them to do a live painting, a nude painting of a very, very fit young man who happens to also be her son. Yeah. So it's added another level of complexity. And she screams at him, you know, get it off in Japanese, which I think might have been a bit of poetic license there. I think he knew what was happening. And then she turns to the students who didn't know what was happening and she says, you also take it off. And 10, you know, not the trimmest of Australians get naked with an apron. So we don't see any.
With an apron. Bits. Yeah. And paintbrushes.
And some of them
that's
get
painted. Accessory.
Yeah, that's right.
I like it. The entertainment industry has been decimated because of COVID-19. Victoria is back in lockdown and restricted movements. What kind of role do you think that comedy has to play during this time?
For better or worse, comedians are not the wealthiest people in Australia, except for Dave Hughes. But everyone else generally subsidises their income through other forms, whether it's a day job, whether it's through writing for TV or whatever it may be. So the stand-up comedians in particular are very humble people. They can get through. It'll be 6 to 8 months for Melbourne. It'll be less for Sydney and the other states. I know that my friends in Adelaide and Sydney are already back on stage. They will survive. They'll have more material. They don't have gigantic mortgages that their friends who are lawyers and doctors and accountants would have. I actually fear for those people more because they possibly don't have the humour to get them through the stressful periods. Mm-hmm. Once we get out of this, my goodness, I think the comedy rooms will fill up. And I think that it's for anyone who feels stressed, you know, we all know, but we need to be reminded that having a laugh is the most stress releasing activity that we can do, possibly one other, but not to be discussed.
won't talk about that one.
The second most important stress reliever is laughter. And we need to support comedians. We need to get out there. And if there's a comedy show going on, get out there, do it for you, do it for the comedian. Comedians themselves don't actually get paid a lot of money. They do get paid per minute more than lawyers and doctors, but they're not performing for 8 hours a day, unfortunately. No. We do need comedy.
I totally agree. But what's it like in China? Do they fall back on something like comedy to help them get through adversity?
The short answer is no. Stand-up comedy is relatively new to China. A friend of mine sent me just a screenshot of a newspaper in Shanghai, and there was a young lady, she's Chinese in her 30s, a Chinese woman in her 30s, and the kind of conversations and the kind of challenges that she has as a female comedian in Shanghai would be similar to a female comedian in Australia in the 80s. that heavy sexism, people looking down on her as a career. You know, it's not suitable for a woman to do that type of material. In Australia, we just go, come on, that's just purely sexist. But that's the reality of China. You know, that's the newspaper today in Shanghai.
So they still haven't really opened up to it by the sounds of it.
They haven't, but if you were to be an investor, you know, if you were going to play the long game in China, there are clubs opening up. There are TV shows opening up. I've got a friend through comedy here in Beijing. He's getting into stand-up comedy, and he also has a TV show that's been produced that is basically stand-up comedy. It's kind of like it starts with a stand-up comedy opening where he's on stage talking to the audience, just like a stand-up comedian, and then it goes into a more of a variety show afterwards. It is happening. Possibly 10 to 15 years ago, it was nothing. It was called, I can't remember the Chinese name, but it's Double Talk. And it was very much your two Ronnies type of humor, you know, who's on first type of comedy, very wordplay comedy, two people on stage. So I think comedy in China is a good 20 years behind Australia, that's for sure.
Okay. Have you got your entrepreneurial hat on? Are you thinking about investing in a Chinese comedy club?
Possibly, because, you know, Is This Thing On? It was filmed entirely in Melbourne, and it was a show that went to different places in Melbourne. We're actually thinking about China and Australia, and in fact, China and the rest of the world aren't getting on very well at the moment. Maybe humour can come to the rescue. We're actually thinking about season two. Maybe this is a shout out to anyone who is interested in supporting us. But season two of Is This Thing On could possibly be more travel. So it's not only humour, but it's also travel. And we would go to places like Sydney this time, then go to Singapore that have a fantastic comedy scene, and then go to Shanghai where they do have two clubs, and then go to Beijing, and then my all-time favourite, which I have been to, Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital city of Mongolia. They have possibly the highest ratio of comedians to residents. In my mind, I was thinking horses at that moment because they do have a lot of horses. They've got more horses than anyone in the world. But Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar capital, they love their comedy, and it's all in Mongolian, which I don't understand. But my God, it's busy every night. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it's packed.
So basically, it'll be a cultural comedy night. It'll be a comedy festival.
Something like that, like each of the 10 comedians, or the newbie comedians, instead of all staying in Melbourne and travelling around Melbourne, they'll get on an aeroplane, they'll travel to Shanghai, they'll travel to Ulaanbaatar, and they'll ride a horse through the plains of Mongolia, and then on that night, they'll do a stand-up gig in a ert. Ert is a Russian word in Mongolian, to a room of, I don't know, 20 Mongolian horse herders.
With red crazy cheeks. I've got the vision already happening in my mind. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, I was made for TV.
It is. I think it is. It'll be quite panoramic, I think.
Yeah, oh, definitely, you know, definitely.
Definitely. Changing tack now. What does courage mean to you?
It is about acknowledging that you have to make difficult decisions, and that feeling uncomfortable is something that you have to be comfortable with. I've said that to any new manager that I've hired. I said, look, I know right now you feel uncomfortable, but you have to feel comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. And that's why you as a manager get paid more than that other person who's an individual contributor.
And it's like being in a business, just get comfortable with being uncomfortable, full stop.
Yep.
You name Dr. Michael Hewitt Gleason as someone that you admire as being courageous. Why is that?
Well, he's a man in his 70s now who lived in New York during the 80s, in the prime of his life, and he's a gay man. He's a proud gay man, and he has seen many of his friends die. Of course, he was in the heart of the HIV epidemic at the time, and thankfully he's a bill of health. He was also in the Vietnam War. And he was one of the Australian soldiers that, you know, had the wrong birth date and was told that he needed to turn up on a certain date at a certain time in Melbourne and go to war and fight an enemy that they didn't even understand or want to fight. And so he's endured a lot, and he's always very positive. And when he came to Shanghai at the age of 60, he was just the most dynamic human that I had ever met at that time, in his 60s. So, yeah, why wouldn't you want to follow in his footsteps?
He sounds like he knew himself and he got really comfortable with himself in a good way. Would that be fair to say?
I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe something, a future interview with Michael Hewitt Gleason is yes. in order to find out why he is such a radical in his thinking. Because, you know, he's in his 70s. He doesn't think like the average 70-year-old Australian. He hasn't become stuck in his ways. It certainly helps having a boyfriend half your age. I won't speak on his behalf, only to say at the end of the day, he does practice what he preaches. He is a lateral thinker. He does believe in CVS to BVS. Current view of the situation is never as good as the better view of the situation. So he's got this toolbox, as he calls a necktop computer, that he can mentally get out of any negative feelings.
Are you courageous?
I have tenacity. That can sometimes be confused for courage. I think courage is doing something even though you're frightened. And I have mastered the ability to hide that fear. And I keep repeating that mantra to myself that you need to feel uncomfortable. You need to be comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. So I did that stand-up comedy course and I was shitting myself. I got through that. I use Britney Spears as an example. It's a really random person to bring up at this point in the conversation. But Britney Spears, I think, was like 3 years old when she broke through her first ceiling of being scared on stage. You know, she was a performer as a little girl. But by the time she was 16, she had broken through so many mental glass ceilings. I'm not talking about the female women glass ceilings, but mental glass ceilings of I can't do that and self-doubt, that by the time she was ready to become an international celebrity, she feared nothing, which can obviously there's an end to that. That where you fear, you make decisions that fear was intended to prevent you from making. You know, she made a few horrible ones. But I think we need to give kids more of those glass ceilings throughout their life that they have to break through. And I was lucky enough for my family to be your middle class, average Australian family that just had enough money to go on holiday and that's about it. So I had to get the paper round and I had to get the job at Safeway and I had to buy my own car. And that creates over time those constant glass ceilings. If you don't have that in your life, you'll get to that point where the time has come where you've got to get that job or you've got to ask for that promotion or you've got to give a presentation that matters.
And you've got it in you. I know you've got it in you, Maureen.
I do. Yes, arrogance is normally the word people use, but all right, thank you.
Final question, would you believe? It takes courage to live your best life because to do so means that you don't actually please everyone. You know, with the decisions that you actually make. And it also means stepping out of your comfort zone, which is what you've spoken about a lot today. So are you actually living your best life or moving towards it at least?
Yes. All good comedians know what a callback is. Callback is where you bring up a joke that you mentioned earlier. And this goes back to Dylan. You know, I have an 11-year-old son called Dylan. And he's named after a 34-year-old friend of mine who died at 34. I'm 45 now, so I'm reminded every single day that he died of a cancer. It was just out of nowhere. He was a fit guy, played rugby, super fit young guy. So, yeah, I live every day like that. I take those risks. It's why I named my son, as a constant reminder to live every day like it's the last.
I think we've come full circle in this interview. It sounds like you are moving into the space of courage. And Dylan's your reminder.
Yes.
Keep going, keep staying courageous. And I want to say thank you so much for being on Courage on Rebel today.
What has stood out for me by talking to Maureen is his ability to get comfortable with uncomfortable. This is a characteristic of being courageous and gritty. I love how he signed up to be a student of comedy and just how scared he was, but he did it anyway. And by doing it, it planted the seed to start an initiative and do it better in true entrepreneurial spirit. To know more about the School of Hard Knock Knocks, jump onto courageunraveled.com/ and you will find details in the show notes under Maureen Morgan and Series 3. Hello to all Australian listeners. How wonderful to know that this podcast series is reaching many parts of Australia. I want to send a big hello and thank you to Nicola Smith, who is in Western Australia, who is listening to the podcasts and using the Courage Journal to empower herself by growing and cultivating her courage muscle. This is what she has to say. I've only just commenced working with the exercises in Sana's Courage Journal and already feel like I'm finding more courage in my life. The statements provide a launching pad for my reflective writing and I've been inspired by others listening to the companion podcasts. I'm looking forward to my courage journey over the next year. Head over to courageunraveled.com to find out more. Stay courageous. Until next time, I'm Sana Turnock, your Courage Unraveled host.